Welcome back to In Search of Tarot, a podcast that examines, questions, and reimagines our approach to life and the cards.
Through guest interviews and in-depth discussions, we'll explore and expand the beautiful complexities of spirituality, philosophy, magic, and more.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Angie.
And we're your hosts for this fascinating ride.
Thanks for being here with us.
Hi, everyone. I am honored to be back with you this week for the final episode of season 4. This has been an amazing season, and we want to thank each and every one of you for listening, for spending this time with us, and each and every one of our incredible guests for being with us. If you enjoy this podcast, please do pass it along to family and friends or post about it on social media. And if you have time, please take a moment to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and or Spotify. I believe now if you are a paid member of Spotify, you can leave ratings there as well. It used to only be Apple Podcasts, but it's possible on Spotify now as well. So we appreciate that. And we also want to thank all of our new Patreon supporters and all of our existing Patreon supporters. Several new people we got to meet at our May Tarot Hang at the beginning of this month. And thanks to all of you on Patreon, we are now only 10 patrons short of reaching our goal of $100 a month on Patreon, which is going to allow us to begin paying our guests next season, as well as continuing to make it possible for us to pay for all of our editing software and the transcription software that we use to transcribe our episodes. So we're still 10 patrons short of that goal. And if just 10 more folks join at the $2 a month level between now and next season, which will probably kick off in August, we will be there. So if you want to support us, head over to patreon.com/insearchoftarot. I'll drop that link in the show notes as well. We've got a lot of exciting things coming up on Patreon over the next couple of months that I want to take a couple moments to tell you about right now. First of all, as I hope all of you know, June is Pride Month, and I will again be hosting my Pride in the Tarot Challenge on Instagram. This is public, this is free for anyone, and this is something that I started last year and was a lot of fun and seemed to be very meaningful for everyone that participated. So this is going to be a set of daily prompts for the entire month of June that are all Pride themed or Pride adjacent. And I had a huge group of people participate in the challenge last year, and it was incredible to follow along and see everyone's polls and read everyone's insights. So I'm going to be releasing the list of prompts on May 31st, and it'll kick off on June 1st. So you can look out for that on Instagram at In Search of Tarot and use hashtag Pride in the Tarot 2022 to join in. Also in June on Patreon, I'm going to be stepping through each of the major arcana cards through the lens or the filter of the Fool. And for me, the Fool, as card number 0 in the tarot, has really come to represent, among other things, the power of the margin and the possibility that exists in marginalized power and identity. So I'll talk more about that on Patreon, but basically we're going to be stepping through each of the major arcana cards, every few days, and just thinking about it through this marginalized lens, through this foolish lens, and kind of expanding on what that can mean beyond what is traditionally taught about these major arcana cards. And then also on Patreon in June, Angie and I are going to be hosting our next monthly virtual tarot hang. That's going to be on Sunday, June 11th at 6 p.m. Eastern. And that's open to any and all Patreon members. This is a time when we come together for about an hour and a half and just kind of talk about tarot and pull some cards and see what comes through. And this hang is going to be Pride themed as well. And we'll be pulling cards in response to some of the themes and questions and experiences that we're all kind of moving through during this month of Pride. So if you'd like to be part of all of this amazingness, please consider supporting this podcast and helping bump us closer to our goal of paying all of our guests by joining our Patreon for as little as $2 a month. And like I said, that's at patreon.com/insearchoftarot, and I'll drop that link in the show notes. All right, let me introduce you to today's guest. We are definitely ending this season on a high note. Angeliska Polacek, they/she, is an Austin, Texas-based writer, healer, and professional tarot reader. Devoted to helping seekers find their path, they utilize the tarot in a compassionate and trauma-informed combination of visionary mystic counseling and energy work. Angeliska has been working with the tarot for over 30 years now and has been reading for clients professionally since 1999. Their dedication and genuine passion for creating joyful and intriguing connections has led to acclaim and recognition from the Chronicle's Best of Austin Awards as Austin's best tarot reader slash psychic for the past 8 years running. Angeliska was born at 11:11 a.m. on the 10th day of the first month of the year. Their other pastimes include elaborate costuming, silversmithing, and reading in the bath. They also love smelling things and remembering the magic light of the golden hour, cobalt blue glass, and the crescent moon. Their writing has been published in NILVX1, The Second, A Book of Magic, The Folk Horror Revival, Corpse Roads, Arcana, the Tarot Poetry Anthology, Coil House Magazine, Tank Magazine, and Astrology.com. You can read their personal writing at angeliska.com and learn more about their tarot divination services and healing work at Sister Temperance Tarot, sistertemperance.com. In this conversation, Angeliska shares a bit about their incredible spiritual upbringing and legacy, as well as the important way that they separate the practice of divination from the practice of prediction. We also discuss the all too often overlooked history of the Romani people within the history of the tarot, and the complicated way that Jewish mysticism has been misapplied within Western esotericism. So please enjoy this final episode of season 4, share this podcast with someone you think will enjoy it, and we'll be back in your ears sometime in August with a very special mini-series that I can't tell you about just yet, but I think you're going to really, really enjoy it. So thank you for being here, everyone. You know, when I was kind of looking through your bio on Instagram, you reference you identify as a Jewish, Romani, Celtic, Slavic witch, and all of those amazing threads, you know, are so full of magical history. And so I would love to just kind of start today by hearing you talk a little bit about your spiritual background and the path that has kind of led you to doing the work that you do now.
Absolutely. And yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for that question. And just calling in the ancestors, calling in all of the people who walked before me, who directly or indirectly led me to be on this path that I am now. And I think a lot of it really starts with my parents. My dad is very much a, you know, full-on Eastern European Jew, but raised in a atheist, agnostic Jewish household. So he is a spiritual seeker who is never, I think very turned on by, you know, anything around Judaism. And, you know, we would sort of go through some of the motions of, you know, basic sort of Hanukkah lighting candles and Seder, you know, but often it was just he and I, and I didn't really get it. And it didn't land for me. And for him, as a, you know, young hippie, in his teens and 20s, he got into Zen Buddhism and was doing that for a long time, and then ended up wandering to Texas, finding my mom, who is, or was, I should say, a mix of Irish, Scottish, various Western European and Romani gypsy lineage. And they, you know, decided to raise me Episcopalian, which also didn't really stick. He was really into that for a while. When my mom died, when I was 7 years old, a few years after that, when I was 11, my dad decided I was ready to have her tarot deck. And he passed on her cards, and he gave me a few different tarot books. He also showed me the I Ching and gave me some books about that, and was basically just like, okay, well, have fun, go for it. And I've always been a very studious person and an autodidact, and so yeah, just went off in my room with those books and really just went to town. And definitely found the I Ching interesting, but the cards were just an immediate rabbit hole that I decided to dive into. And you know, around that same time, my dad had remarried. He married my stepmom, who is Mexican and Native American. And so we started go we left the our the Episcopalian church we were all going to, after there were some like scandals at the church. And we were going to Medicine Wheels twice a year, so traditional Native American Medicine Wheels here in Austin. And my stepmom was also working with the student-led coalition for Native American students at UT. So we would have meetings at our house, and my parents were married in the wheel, so that was very beautiful to witness and get to experience, you know, that in my upbringing. And then at a certain point, they became devotees of Satya Sai Baba and like started going to India, starting to go to ashrams. And it's been a long journey. Now they're like back at the Episcopalian church. So, you know, I think that being raised in a household where I was around a lot of like, you know, esoteric wisdom, and being raised by, you know, these spiritual seekers who would switch things up a lot. Oh, my dad also had like a sacred harp singing phase, which I thought was really strange. But now I'm like, oh, that was really cool. I didn't know that my upbringing was unusual until I was around other kids. And I realized how strange, truly strange I was.
Yeah, well, I was wondering because, well, first of all, that is incredible. I mean, what an amazing childhood and energies and influences to grow up around. I mean, that's all of that is so incredible. And I was thinking about, I was always a kid that was very drawn to spirituality from, a very young age, but no one in my family is particular, like I was raised religiously, but I wouldn't say I was raised very spiritually, and sometimes I've kind of wondered what it would have been like, or sort of wish that I'd had more of a spiritual influence in my life, or someone growing up that I could have spoken with about these things. But then I also wonder if it might have kind of pushed me away from it, because as you were saying, sometimes when you're surrounded by it, as a child, you kind of rebel against maybe whatever your parents are kind of pushing on you, or you want to like become your own person, and kind of find your own path. So yeah, so I was curious, when kind of what that was like for you. You mentioned that you weren't always thinking about going into this. So was there a time where you were moving away from it, and how did you move back towards it? Like what brought you back to it?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I definitely felt that, and it's really funny for people who are raised by eccentric hippies. Like we have to find kind of creative ways to rebel. And you know, my dad really, you know, he pushed spirituality on me in a way that even as a very young child, I resented. Like I remember pretending I didn't know how to read for a long time when I was a kid, which my dad was like in just in agony about, the thinking that I wasn't going to be a reader, when in secret I was like reading by four, but I didn't want to let him know because he was trying to make me read Bible stories, and I just found them to be so incredibly dull. And I was just like, can we get back to old Yeller? Like this is not the thing. Yeah, I remember coming out of the broom closet, so to speak, and feeling like, yeah, that I was going to have something to defend. And so it was a little bit of a shock when, oh my gosh, just in the last like 10 years, it has become so trendy to be into tarot and astrology and crystals and all the things where, you know, for a long time it felt very, very niche and very, yeah, like you kind of had to find, you had to find the magic within the magic, because there was also a lot of just, yeah, you know, to be honest, cheesy crap. But you know, that being said, I don't think I ever pushed away my relationship to my own witchery. And when I was 19, I moved to New Orleans, and pretty quickly, you know, I got a job as a waitress, which I was very bad at. So pretty quickly, I realized that I was not going to be making much in the way of tips, and I needed to figure out something else. And I went past this occult shop in the French Quarter, and I was like, I'm going to get a job there, and I'm going to read tarot there. And I did. And so that's really how I kicked off reading professionally for people. And I remember also around that time when I had moved to New Orleans, I had a friend who was an Ungan, and he was initiated in Haiti, and he and his Haitian family would do these big, elaborate, beautiful, very traditional Haitian voodoo ceremonies. And I was going to these ceremonies, and you know, staying up until 4 in the morning dancing and talking with Lawat. It was really something that spoke to me, because I remember even as a young kid, like getting books about voodoo and you know, seeing these images of veves and just recognizing something in them and feeling very strangely at home with this cosmology. And when I told my dad about that, it was just, I remember so vividly his response in an email. He was like, "Oh, I'm so happy that you've found your path, and that this is the tradition that you're exploring, and that this is going to be your religion. And you know, are you going to get initiated?" He was just like so supportive and thrilled. And I was like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa! You know, I'm not saying that like this is the path that I'm necessarily going to go down. Like that's a big commitment. I don't know that I'm ready for that." I remember thinking how special it was that there are so many people, if they you know, emailed their parents that they were attending voodoo ceremonies in New Orleans, that you know, the parents would be like, "We're getting in the car right now. We're gonna go pick you up." Like, no, this can't happen, you know. And just the fact that, yeah, that I was raised in a family where I had so much support.
Yeah,
So.
I'm curious for you, having had all of these amazing influences, including New Orleans. I mean, that's just another thing to throw into the mix, that's amazing. But something that a lot of people that you hear talked about a lot in spirituality is this sense that, everything is kind of pointing to the same truth, or there's some sort of underlying, oneness to all of the different paths. But I'm wondering how that sits for you, and if you feel that, if there is any commonality that you've experienced through all of the different paths that you've been exposed to, or if for you it's they're more separate or more nuanced, or just how do you feel about that idea that underneath everything there's some kind of commonality?
You know, for me, it really is more about finding the connections. And even as a really young child, I was fascinated by the concept of syncretism and drawing lines and just being able to notice, okay, you see this here, and you also see it here, and you see it here. And so what's that about? You know, it's not an accident that we have this mythos of little people or fairies or elves that are very, very similar the world over in so many different cultures, right? Why we honor the dead in so many different cultures in the fall, in November, right? In October, November, like that's, you know, even on the same dates in a lot of different cultures that aren't even really connected by Catholicism, right? And especially with, yeah, my relationship with Oya, seeing how she's syncretized with various god forms and elemental spirits, her relationship with Brigid and the Kaliach has been really interesting for me to look at. And the fact that my mother gave me Brigid as a middle name. And for a long time, I didn't really get it, and I didn't really know what it was about. And then, years later, coming to really discover, like, oh yeah, like I am a child of Bridget. Like that is absolutely correct. And my mother somehow like knew this. But yeah, when you see different, whether it's gods and goddesses or Orisha, different deities, different folk tales, different mythos. It was really wild. I remember years ago I was in Bali and I would be seeing these like frog and princess statues everywhere. And I'm a big frog person. Mm-hmm. And I was asking like, what's up with the frog and the princess? And they told me this story that was like the frog prince. It was exactly the frog prince. And mm-hmm. I was like, so where did this story come from? Like, oh, it's, you know, ancient Balinese story. And I'm like, okay, so, you know, it's like one of those chicken egg things where you're like, right. Well, where did it come from first? But the fact that you see it in so many far-flung and disparate places, I won't go as far to say like, oh, everything's connected and everything's the same wherever you go. But I find that, you know, especially when you're dealing with like animal stories or elemental stories, and I think, yeah, these god forms that that do travel, right? They get around, and they mm-hmm. do find the people who are going to resonate with them and keep them alive. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that's accidental.
Right.
I don't know if that really answers the question, but yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I just read Neil Gaiman's American Gods. Have you ever read American
yeah.
Gods?
Oh. Couple times, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Me too. I had never read it before, and oh my gosh, it blew my mind. But I love that idea of the gods traveling, and like you said, you know, whoever they find kind of keeps them alive by believing in them, and you know, it's very, very interesting. With all of the talk, you know, that we've had so far about all of these converging paths and influences, I'd love to now dig in a little bit with you about some, you know, complicated issues that come up with tarot, particularly with Romani culture, and also with Jewish appropriation. My fiance is Jewish, and we talk about this a lot as well. And I had Zoe Jacoby on last season on the podcast, and she also dove a lot into some of the, you know, Kabbalah appropriation and just different complications there with the Golden Dawn. But, you know, let's start with the history of cartomancy in Romani culture, which is, you know, a big part of the story of the history of that culture. And just how, you know, what have you grown up hearing or learning about that? And what are your feelings, as much as you care to share about that, as far as the way it applies to tarot and the way that, like you said, tarot has really come into the mainstream and is used by many different people of many different cultures now, and just how you feel about all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say that, you know, for my experience, coming from Romani ancestry, that was very much assimilated and very much lost as a matter of survival, mm-hmm. In this country. To me, some of the biggest wounds, especially for American Romani descendants, is the trauma of erasure and the trauma of assimilation. And I see that erasure so much, especially as tarot has become, again, this very trendy thing where like everybody in their, you know, grandma has a wild unknown deck and yeah. like, I'm a tarot. I've been reading tarot for 2 months and now I'm a tarot reader. And I'm right. like, you know, I don't believe that tarot is or should be a closed practice. You know, I know there are people who feel that way, and I'm not going to tell anyone what to believe or how to live, really. I would like to see more acknowledgement, mm-hmm. and especially just in this sort of like, you know, witchy boho. I'm using that in quotes because my family is actually on my dad's side from Bohemia. We are actually Bohemians. There's just this still in 2022 an enormous lack of understanding around what those words actually mean, who the Romani people actually are. You know, still such every day a huge prevalence on Instagram, on Etsy, of people with like gypsy soul or whatever mm-hmm. in their handle. And they really fundamentally do not understand that word does not mean wanderer or free spirit. It, you know, that it refers to an ethnicity, it refers to people who are still actively being persecuted against. There's so much prejudice, and prejudice very much, you know, from, like, I guess I should say people who know better. You know, I just got into a really painful thing with somebody that I'm friends with on Facebook, who, you know, I posted for International Romani Day, just reposted like a really great thread from Romani Scientist, who's an amazing person on Instagram. And yeah, this friend was like, oh, all the gypsies I know are thieves and scam artists. And, you know, and I was like, wow, that's a really messed up thing to be posting on this thread on this day. Like, what, why do you think that that's okay? And we had to get into like a really long thing about why he thought it was okay. And it hurts, you know, I will say, like, it hurts. And it hurts to be disconnected from culture. I think that for a lot of people from various like diasporic and mixed backgrounds, to, you know, really just be grasping at threads of tradition, also knowing that our experiences are going to be so fundamentally different than people who are raised in those cultures and raised in those traditions, right? And I try to be very careful about, you know, I think like what, you know, what it is to reclaim your culture, and then also to claim something that, you know, for a lot of Romani people, they would look at me and be like, well, you know, you don't follow our traditions. You don't follow our ways. Like, you're Gajo. You don't, like, you're not part of this. It doesn't matter what blood you have, you know? And I think it's a similar thing where in the reclaiming that I see a lot of, which is very complex and difficult, you know, with people claiming, you know, indigenous lineage, where a lot of their relatives were forced to assimilate, lost their language, lost their traditions, were not allowed to practice their traditions, were not allowed to practice their ways. And again, a lot of it is for survival in white supremacist culture. So to see that erasure and that just lack of, lack of awareness, lack of knowledge, and then to see people claiming something that, they're just, you know, there's not the respect. And you think about, you know, this conversation, which we've been having for a long time now, needs to be had around cultural appropriation and, you know, versus appreciation. I'm so glad that you got to have that conversation with Zoe Jacoby. And I would say that, yeah, like, they're probably so much more, definitely so much more knowledgeable about, you know, the Kabbalistic and Jewish references in the tarot. To be really honest, a lot of the deeply esoteric aspects and symbolism of the tarot, like, it's kind of that stuff that you absorb and then, you know, do I use it in my day-to-day practice with people? Not as much. And I think that when I look at, like, I think about a lot of the tarot meetups and circles and things that I attended when I was younger and had a lot of people who were not from Jewish lineage, you know, spouting various things about Kabbalah and the Tree of Life and, you know, the Hebrew letter for this or for that to me. And I was just like, yeah, it's interesting choices. really. And I think in some ways it's not necessary to hang on to that stuff, I think, in the way that non-Jewish people do. And I remember definitely, like, the trend around Kabbalah and Madonna and, you know, all of this stuff that I just remember being so perplexed by it. And I think a lot of Jewish people were very perplexed by, like, what are you doing, really? You know, and like, and why? You know, because there are so many different things to explore that, I don't know. I find it to be a little bit baffling. And as far as the Golden Dawn and the way that Jewish mysticism and symbolism shows up in the Smith Rider-Waite deck, you know, I'm very conflicted about it, because I will just say this, you know, I have such a deep love and appreciation for Pamela Coleman, Pixie Smith, mm-hmm. as like a queer woman of a mixed woman of color, you know, who I think was handed a lot of this information and kind of was like, okay, cool. Yeah, I'm going to do my own thing with it. Mm-hmm. And I really feel like she channeled so much of the imagery in that deck. And, you know, she had the notes, she had the knowledge, she had the things, but she really, you know, I think much in the same way that Lady Freda Harris did, she really brought these images through. Mm-hmm. And that's what I hold on to, is just the power of the imagery and the lessons that just continue to unfold. And the deck that I inherited from my mother was the Albano printing of the Rider-Waite deck, mm-hmm. which is what I still use to read for clients with and to teach on. And the colors are very vibrant. You know, it was reprinted in the 70s, so it's like very saturated, and mm-hmm. It's great. And, you know, my mother was a huge Pre-Raphaelite fan, like mm-hmm. very influenced by the Pre-Raphaelites and their ethos and their, you know, their mysticism. And, and you know, they were kind of like the proto hippies of their day. And I think a lot of what she loved about those cards was sort of that, like, Pre-Raphaelite hippie mysticism that you see in a lot of the imagery of the 60s and 70s, like a lot of the band posters and a lot of, you know, this appreciation for nature and for myth and for things to be very well made. I think about the William Morris maxim, have nothing in your possession which you do not know to be useful or believe to be beautiful. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when I look at a lot of the blending and the amalgams and the influences that were happening that kind of got us to this point, I feel like there's kind of a lot that you just have to, I will say, I just have to forgive and accept, because mm-hmm. we're here, and just continue to educate and to like make people aware, and the people who are receptive to that are going to, and there's going to be plenty of people who are going to continue to ignore it and to just sort of bypass a lot of the roots and the origins that, you know, that still require acknowledgement.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when I, as a white person, like when I reflect on how I came into tarot, you know, I think why I tend to spend a lot of time talking about the Smith Rider-Waite deck and kind of questioning the Golden Dawn and wanting to kind of move beyond all of that is just no one really told me what I was stepping into. You know, it was just all part of just tarot. I mean, I had no idea. I came into tarot completely from left field, you know, with no background, you know, just it was something that I was just interested in. And no teacher that I had early on explained that I was learning based on a system, you know, and who the people were that created that. Now, I mean, yes, of course, I also upon reflection, like, well, I could have wondered who I was learning from, but I just feel like I didn't have any frame of reference. I didn't even really know to ask that question, which maybe is, you know, naive of me, but, that's what I really wish I saw more of, was just a transparency about it, and kind of, and also an option that there's another way. But really, it's just a hunger for people to be more transparent about the sources of this symbolism, the sources of these associations, and not teaching them always as if they are just fact, you know?
Mm. Yeah, that they just kind of came out of nowhere.
Right, right. Right. Yes, yeah. Yes.
And I think that's something that you see so much, you know, with spirituality and just with colonization in general. It's like, oh, look, I just conveniently found this thing here and somebody just left it, and I'll just pick it up and adapt it to my uses. And of course, you know, it is never that simple. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always so much more to the story. And I think, yeah, the people that are interested in delving deeper are going to find that. And the information, you know, it is there, I think, more and more. But mm-hmm. When I look at a lot of, you know, even the books that were available at the, you know, at my local library as a kid, you know, there are a lot of books about tarot and a lot of, you know, varied perspectives and a lot of books about the history of tarot. And still, I think a lot is missing, mm-hmm. you know, from those narratives and from the understanding, you know. And I'm just so glad to think about some of the, you know, the books that have come out in the last few years that I think really flesh out the story. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm.
And what you were sharing earlier really was demonstrating the long-term devastation of white supremacy, you know, the way that you were saying, you know, well, people assimilation happens. It's not as if you can just one day snap your fingers and kind of completely reclaim what you've lost. I mean, it's, you know, years and generations of forced assimilation, and, you know, and then it's so complicated. There's so much to untie and untangle and unpack, and the damage is kind of done, you know?
Yeah.
I'm wondering now, along these same lines, I know that you had listened to the conversation I was able to have with Jonathan Coe, and I really appreciated in that episode when they were talking about divination as a human right. I'd never really, you know, thought of it that way, and that it should be a human right to be able to commune with the divine. And I'm wondering for you, in your practice, what are some of the frameworks that you've kind of built for yourself around divination, and are there any specific ways that you hold yourself accountable, or any boundaries that you establish with yourself or with your clients, or just, you know, if these are questions that you've wrestled with at all, you know, as you've built your practice over the years?
Yeah, absolutely. And my goodness, that conversation was just so beautiful to get to listen to. And I learned so much, especially from, you know, those specific things really stood out for me, this idea that divination is a right and where that fits in with time magic. And so appreciated their like Piscean fluid relationship to time, which is a Pisces rising. I was very much vibing with. And it's a disclaimer that I'll make to my clients when I'm reading for them. One, I don't make predictions. And it's interesting because I think until I listened to that conversation between you two, that I think that it had not occurred to me to use the word divination in context with prediction. To me, divination is a conversation with the divine. It is divining information, which people may think, you know, is relevant in terms of past, present, future. But the way that I work with time is kind of that we're always in the now, right? I love the saying, like, the past is history, the future is a mystery, the present is a gift. And this idea that the most accurate way to predict the future is to create it, like what we are doing, what we have not resolved from the past completely affects the present. And what we do in the present absolutely affects what happens next. Right. And it's very important to me, I think, especially with this idea that people have that, that tarot readers, especially have some like omniscient ability to look into the future and to know what's going to happen. And I find that one, improbable, unlikely, and also very disempowering to my clients. And so I'm very, very careful when I'm reading for people around how I deliver that information, right? And there are times where, you know, always, again, always with the disclaimer, I do not make predictions. I'm not going to tell you what's going to happen. I can't tell you what's going to happen. But given the circumstances that we have, it's kind of like the weather, right? It's kind of like a meteorologist is like, we have all the makings for a tornado. You have all the makings for a real tower situation here. It's a tower watch. I could let you know when we're having a tower warning. The way that you're going and the things that you are doing in your life could lead to a cosmic bitch slap from the universe if you're not careful, you know? So heads up, you may want to change your course of direction. I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm not saying you're going to get fired, but you might want to prepare for that. You might want to consider that. And then it's really interesting because often I will have clients, most of my practice is working with people on a very like regular basis. So I'll have sometimes people come back and say, oh, you know, last time you read for me, you told me this and this and this was going to happen. And I'm like, no, I really didn't. I promise I didn't say it like that. But it's funny the way that the information lodges in people's minds.
I appreciate that distinction that you just made between divination and prediction. I have not thought about that. I definitely always did attach like a prediction kind of feeling to divination, but I definitely hear, I can see what you're saying, you know, and that makes a lot of sense. And it's also very beautiful nuance, you know, and because of the root of divination being divine, like you said. And quickly, I did want to discuss with you a little bit in this conversation about the way that you view gender in your spirituality and your magic. And that sort of leads me into that question because I, you know, being non-binary, I really struggle with what people mean when they talk about divine feminine and divine masculine. And, you know, this is a huge topic that I'm sure we will not have time to fully flesh out. But something struck me when you made that distinction about the word divination. And, you know, this, I don't have it yet, but I'm going to kind of sit with what would it mean to think about divination as being something divine. You know, because I recently posted about divine feminine and divine masculine, and someone said, well, why can't we just call it divine energy? You know, why do we have to use these terms, which at least in white Western culture are definitely gendered, in my opinion, you know, and maybe it is possible for other people of other cultures or, you know, BIPOC people to be able to use those words in more expansive ways. But I feel as a white person that it's really very, very difficult to push against the intense, you know, societal conditioning that we're born into of those words being just so gendered, you know. But now I'm kind of thinking, you know, what would it mean to divine and divination as being a more expansive way to explore that. But you know, one of your posts on Instagram recently that I really loved was your imagining the moon in drag. Because the moon and the sun are things that do kind of often get gendered in Western magical traditions, you know. And so, yeah, so just, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, huge, but I would love to hear you talk a bit about, you know, how you explore gender, the role that gender plays in your practice, if at all, and maybe how you feel about gender representation in the tarot, and just anything along those lines that you'd like to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for that. It is a struggle. I mean, in this culture that we are living in, so, you know, Western white culture, where the gender essentialism has been pushed so hard, and where I'm seeing, gosh, just in the last couple of years, even among, you know, people, practitioners that I really respected, this very intense pushing of divine masculine, divine feminine as these, like, you know, these things to aspire to, and these categories that you're either in or you're out. And the last couple years of pandemic have been profound self-realization for me. I am chronically ill, high risk, very isolated, and have spent a lot of time with myself. And went from being, you know, a quite social person who was doing a lot in the world and with people to becoming, you know, very, very much embodying the hermit card. And in that hermit journey of know thyself, you know, one of the big things that really came clear to me in not having to perform femininity on a regular basis is that who I am out of femme drag is a non-binary or agender person. And I hadn't really gotten to hang out with that person very much. Mm-hmm. And that person doesn't get seen very much in the world. Mm-hmm. And it was, very, really tough in a lot of ways for me, to reckon with that. And also an enormous blessing to be at the point that I am, to be at 43 years old, and to finally have arrived at a point in our culture where I'm starting to have language for who and how I am. Mm. And I'm starting to be able to explain that and have that be understood, and also reckon with the pain of 4 decades on this earth, not having that language and not having that understanding and not having that awareness, not seeing myself represented, not seeing the non-binary, not seeing the other, mm-hmm. Which I don't know if you have ever checked out Jonah Welch's work, but they are one of my dearest friends and just an incredible trans queer mystic, who I highly recommend you have a chat with at some point. Mm. They have done some beautiful writing, that, I remember some really potent conversations that we had around this visual that's always been very, very live for me, especially in the lover's card, of this triangle, where it's like, okay, sure, there's the masculine, that exists, the feminine, that exists, those are real things, they exist. And then there's this other thing that isn't really either of those things. Maybe it's a combination or an amalgamation of those things, and maybe it's neither. Mm-hmm. And I see that as the angel in the lover's card. Mm-hmm. And the power of this other being that is maybe androgynous or genderless or a combination doesn't get that representation. And I think that, one of the things about spirituality and gender is that, spirituality in general, I think that we are comfortable putting things in little boxes and categorizing things. Mm-hmm. That's just, how humans kind of work. We like to make meaning out of things, and we like to dress things up and put costumes on things. And mm-hmm. when you're looking at the divine, it is very overwhelming, and I think terrifying, and a little bit less friendly, maybe, to perceive God as this giant, omniscient, ever-present, all-encompassing energy. Mm-hmm. And so I really appreciate, pantheistic religions and spiritualities. We're like, big God. Yeah, there's big God. But big God is busy creating the universe and stuff and keeping everything going. And I got a problem with my gambling, so I need to go talk to gambling God. And I have an issue with my bread, so I need to talk to bread goddess over yeah. here, or monkey God or whoever it is. And, we put a mask on all of these different kind of smaller, pieces of God, on God's finger or God's big toe, and are like, okay, can you be the elephant one? Because I need to talk to the elephant one today. Mm-hmm. Can you be the moon lady? Because I got to talk to the moon lady mm-hmm. about this stuff, moon lady stuff. Okay. and it's all, to me, it's all drag, mm-hmm. God, it's like the RuPaul quote, you're born naked and the rest is drag. Well, God was born naked and the rest is drag. We're putting God into drag. We're putting God into costumes to have conversations with these aspects of the divine so we can feel more comfortable about it. Mm-hmm. And, it's to me as meaningful and meaningless as noticing that in different languages, different things are gendered in different ways. Mm-hmm. and why, why is the chair feminine? Why is the, mm-hmm. teacup mask? I don't know, and it is irrelevant in some ways. And it's also significant in other ways. And playing with costume and playing with makeup and playing with guys and with glamour, these are shamanistic explorations. Mm-hmm. They always have been. Mm-hmm. And, to dress up as the ancestors, to dance as the ghost or as the sun god or whatever it is, these are things that we've been doing, again, in many different cultures all over the world for a long time. There's a reason why white Christian culture is so deeply offended by the fluidity of that and has this really strong need to box people in and to say it's this or it's that, and that's all there is available. You get these two flavors and that's it.
Yeah, but it's just, it's such a huge part of our magical community. You know, it's just, it's so, such a big piece of it. And, you know, just so thank you for kind of exploring that a little bit with me.
Yeah, absolutely. And to answer like one other piece that you asked of like, how does that come into the tarot and how I work with the tarot, right? Because especially being someone who works with the Smith-Waite deck, you know, it's a pretty gendered deck.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done my best with markers and nail polish to adjust. You know, I've melanated my deck so it's more representational for all of the different kinds of people that I read for, and I've made a lot of the major arcana, you know, not white, but also not even really human. So in the Lovers, like I painted sort of the male looking, who knows, figure like pink, and the feminine figure is tangerine colored, and the star is like mostly just glitter and sparkles now. And it's like, you can't really, you maybe can't really tell. And the way that I work with the court cards, especially, which, you know, king, queen, knight, prince, you know, page or princess is very ungendered and really has been for a long time, because I work with the court cards in a, you know, in a bit of a different way than I think some readers do, that they're all aspects of ourselves. And is the energy going outward? Is it going inward? You know, it's interesting how, of course, a lot of that does end up being very gendered, you know, whether it's this active principle or this passive, more receptive principle, which doesn't always, you know, necessarily track, again, across the elements and these aspects of human experience that those cards encompass. And again, it's so fun when I get to talk about this stuff with people, you know, and get to encourage people to play, you know, and to turn things on their heads and to play with it. And drag actually comes into my readings like quite a bit, because it's one of the forms of self-expression that I think we get discouraged out of, just like singing, dance, art, you know, all of these different ways of healing ourselves and understanding ourselves. Dressing up and being in costume and inhabiting a different character for a little while is a really powerful practice.
Well, Angeliska, thank you so much for this incredible conversation. I really appreciate you diving into all these different topics, and I've loved hearing about your past and learning a little bit more about what's made you who you are today. And I want to let people know how they can find you and how they can work with you. So we just share a little bit about where people can discover you and your work.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so much for having me here and being able to connect with you in this way and with your listeners is such a treat and a delight. And all of this, the standard social media methods, Instagram and Facebook, I'm Sister Temperance Tarot. I'm on Twitter just a little bit, mostly lurking and laughing at stuff as just my name, Angeliska. You can find me, my personal accounts everywhere as Angeliska. My personal website, which is a pretty neglected blog now devoted just to mainly pieces about grieving, is angeliska.com. My also very neglected but hopefully soon to be redazzled, I don't know if that's the word, is sistertemperance.com, and the links to book with me, to my booking site, are also there. And yeah, I think that's the main ways. I do of course free live tarot broadcasts for the new and full moon on Instagram Live. And those are really fun conversations, and I've really enjoyed having you in those circles when you've popped in. And yeah, would be thrilled to connect with anyone who's resonated with whatever I've shared here.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Yes. I've loved those lives. Everyone should definitely check that out if nothing else. All right. Well, thank you so much for this time. Thank you for listening to In Search of Tarot. You can follow Angie on Instagram at birdgirl _. That's BIRDGERHL_. And you can follow me, Nick, at In Search of Tarot. This podcast is independently recorded, edited, and produced by us, which means that we rely solely on the generous support of our Patreon backers to make this podcast happen. If you'd like to lend us your support, you can do so for as little as $2 a month over on patreon.com/insearchoftarot.